Welcome back, everyone. Ready to dive into another fascinating world.
Absolutely. I'm excited for this one.
This time we're tackling George Orwell's 1984, a classic dystopia. And let me tell you, it's eerily relevant even today.
It really is. Orwell had a knack for seeing through the cracks of society, predicting things. Well, maybe not predicting, but certainly exploring themes that resonate even stronger now.
Exactly. So we've got a ton of great listener comments and questions on this one. So let's get right to it. All right.
Let's do it.
One thing that always strikes me about 1984, so Orwell doesn't just like describe a totalitarian state, but he really gets into the nitty gritty of how it maintains control, you know?
Oh, absolutely. He peels back the layers, exposes the machinery of oppression. It's chillingly effective.
Right. Like, he's giving us a manual on how to spot tyranny. And he doesn't waste any time either, does he? That opening line, "It was a bright, cold day in April and the clocks were striking 13.
Brilliant, isn't it? Immediately, you're off kilter. Something's not right. Even time itself is suspect.
Totally. Time, history, it's all up for grabs in Oceania.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who maybe haven't read it in a while, can you paint us a picture of this world Orwell creates?
Imagine a world divided between three superstates: Oceania, Eurasia, and Eastasia, constantly at war. A war that never really ends, a war with no real purpose, except, of course, to maintain the party's grip on power.
So a manufactured conflict to keep the masses distracted. Classic tactic, right?
Timeless, really. And within Oceania, we find ourselves in Airstrip 1, formerly known as England. This is where we meet our protagonist, Winston Smith.
Winston, man, what a character. Just trying to hold on to a shred of individuality in a world where that's basically a crime. What's his life like? What's it like to be Winston Smith?
You wake up in your drab apartment, Victory Mansion, they call it, though there's nothing victorious about it. The telescreen blares propaganda 24/7, watching your every move. You choke down your breakfast victory coffee and some tasteless, gritty stuff that passes for food. And you dread another day at the Ministry of Truth.
Where, ironically, he's tasked with rewriting history, right?
The ultimate irony. He's a cog in the machine designed to distort truth, erase the past, and reshape reality to fit the party's narrative. It's like, how much of his world is manipulation versus self-deception?
It's terrifying to think about, honestly. And to enforce this control, the party has its ministries. And each one is more Orwellian than the last.
Oh, absolutely. You've got the Ministry of Truth, Winston's stomping grounds, churning out propaganda, twisting facts. Then there's the Ministry of Love, which sounds nice, but it's actually the center of fear and repression.
Yeah.
They're the ones with the thought police, the torture chambers, Room 101, all that.
Oh, Room 101, just the thought of it sends chills down my spine.
And then, if that wasn't enough, there's the Ministry of Peace, which ironically oversees the never-ending war, because, of course, to have peace, you must prepare for war, or at least that's what they want you to believe.
Right. The irony is almost unbearable.
Yeah.
And to round it all out, you have the Ministry of Plenty, responsible for the economy, which is, let's be honest, anything but plentiful.
It's almost comical, the names they choose, but the reality behind them is terrifyingly real. It's this manipulation of language, this creation of newspeak that's truly insidious.
Absolutely. By controlling language, they control thought. It's like a virus infecting the very way people think and communicate.
Exactly. It's mental imprisonment, far more effective than any physical cage.
And it's in this world, this oppressive, tightly controlled world, that Winston dares to rebel. But it starts subtly, doesn't it?
It does. It's a slow burn. He buys a diary, a simple act. But in Oceania, a dangerous one, because that diary represents a space for his own thoughts, his own truth.
He's carving out this little corner of rebellion just for himself.
Exactly. It's his own private act of resistance. But it's not enough for him, is it? He's drawn to the past, to a time before the party.
Which leads him to that antique shop, right? The one in the Pearl District.
Yes. Mr. Charrington's shop. It's like a portal to a forgotten world. Filled with these, well, remnants of a time when beauty and individuality weren't considered dangerous.
And that's where he finds that glass paperweight,
hey,
right?
Yeah. The paperweight, such a beautiful symbol, so fragile. A tiny piece of the past encased in this delicate sphere of glass. Just like Winston's hopes, perhaps.
And just like Winston's hopes, it's eventually shattered, isn't it?
Tragically, yes. But for a while, it represents something pure, something real in a world of manufactured truth. And then, of course, there's Julia.
Ah, Julia. Now, she represents a whole different kind of rebellion.
Doesn't she? Where Winston is drawn to the intellectual side rebellion, Julia, she's all about the physical. the sensual.
She rebelled through pleasure, through her own personal freedom.
Exactly. She sees the party trying to control not just what people think, but how they feel, their emotions, their desires, and she refuses to let them have that power.
The relationship is interesting, isn't it? Because
Right.
it's dangerous, obviously, but it's also this act of defiance against the party's attempt to control every aspect of their lives.
Absolutely. Those stolen moments, the passion, the intimacy, it's all a direct challenge to the party's cold, sterile vision of the world.
And those stolen moments become even more significant in that room they rent above the antique shop, right?
It becomes their sanctuary, a haven from the telescreens and the ever-present threat of the thought police. For a little while, at least.
It seems like they can almost forget about the party, lost in their own little world.
Almost. But the party's reach is long, isn't it? It always finds a way. And let's be honest, the way Orwell sets up the party's control, it's masterful. The surveillance, the telescreens everywhere, the thought police, it creates this atmosphere of constant fear and paranoia.
But the control goes even deeper, doesn't it? They're not just monitoring your actions, they're controlling your thoughts.
Absolutely. Newspeak, their attempt to simplify language, to shrink vocabulary, it's terrifyingly effective.
Because by limiting language, they're limiting thought itself.
Exactly. And then there's doublethink, this ability to hold two contradictory beliefs at the same time and believe both of them.
It's mind-bending, right?
It's essential for survival in Oceania. You have to accept the party's version of reality, even when it contradicts your own senses. Like when Oceania's enemy suddenly switches from Eurasia to East Asia and everyone acts like it's always been that way. Or the case of Jones, Aronson, and Rutherford.
Those party members who were declared enemies of the state then reappeared, confessed to crimes they didn't commit, and then disappeared again.
Vaporized from history, erased. And the most frightening part is people believe it. Or at least they pretend to.
Because to question it, to even think about it, is dangerous. So in this world where truth is so fluid, so easy to manipulate, how can any kind of resistance possibly take hold?
It's the question that haunts the entire novel, isn't it? Where can hope possibly exist in such a tightly controlled system?
Winston seems to find some hope in the proles, doesn't he? The working class who seem less affected by the party's ideology.
He sees something genuine in their lives, something the party hasn't been able to completely crush, their capacity for love, for anger, for simple human connection.
But is it enough? Can the proles really be the ones to break free? Or are they, as the party claims, just simple, easily manipulated masses?
It's hard to say for sure. Orwell leaves that question open. And then, of course, there's O'Brien.
O'Brien. Now, there's an enigma wrapped in a mystery, right? He's this inner party member, shrouded in secrecy, and Winston becomes convinced he's part of the resistance.
O'Brien becomes this symbol of hope for Winston, this beacon of rebellion in a sea of conformity. But he also represents Winston's fatal flaw, don't you think?
Which is?
His tendency to project his own hopes and desires onto others, to see what he wants to see rather than facing the harsh reality of his situation.
And that meeting, finally, in O'Brien's luxurious apartment, it's both exhilarating and terrifying, isn't it?
Because you just know deep down that it can't possibly end well.
It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion.
Yeah.
You know what's coming, but you can't look away.
And the worst part is the betrayal is almost foreshadowed from the beginning, isn't it?
It is. There are all these little hints, these cracks in the facade that make you realize Winston and Julia never really stood a chance.
Like that fragile glass paperweight shattering, the ever-present threat of the telescreens, the thought police always lurking in the shadows, even the very structure of Oceania, this society built on control and surveillance.
It's suffocating just thinking about it. They're trapped from the start, aren't they?
It's like a spider web. No matter how much they struggle, how much they try to break free, they only become more entangled.
And right at the heart of that web, that's where the Ministry of Love awaits.
The place where love goes to die. More like the Ministry of Fear, really.
Oh, yeah. And that's where Winston's rebellion is finally completely, utterly dismantled.
Piece by piece, they take apart his spirit, his identity, his very essence.
The psychological torture is almost worse than the physical, isn't it?
It is. Because they understand that to truly control someone, you have to control their mind, their thoughts, their beliefs, their perceptions.
And they break him, don't they? They force him to betray everything he holds dear.
And they do it systematically. Starvation, beatings, electroshock therapy. But it's the mental manipulation that's truly terrifying.
The way they distort his sense of reality, twisting his memories, making him doubt his own sanity.
Exactly. They want him to question everything he thought he knew, everything he thought he believed in.
And O'Brien, the man Winston trusted, the man he believed was on his side, he becomes the architect of Winston's destruction.
The ultimate betrayal. And yet, O'Brien genuinely believes he's doing the right thing, doesn't he? He sees himself as Winston's savior, guiding him towards the truth, the party's truth, that is.
It's chilling. O'Brien represents the true believer, the one who has fully embraced the party's ideology, no matter how twisted it may seem to us.
And he wants Winston to experience that same enlightenment, to love Big Brother,
yeah,
to embrace the party as his savior.
It seems impossible, doesn't it? To force someone to love something they hate, to believe something they know is a lie.
And yet, that's the party's ultimate goal, isn't it? Total control, not just over your actions, but over your thoughts, your feelings, your very soul.
And they achieve that control, in part, through Room 101. That's where the true horror of the party's methods becomes terrifyingly real.
Room 101. Everyone has their own personal hell. For Winston, it's rats.
Don't even get me started on the rats.
It's not just about inflicting pain, though. It's about breaking down the individual's last vestiges of resistance, their core sense of self.
And when Winston begs for them to torture Julia instead of him, that's the moment, isn't it?
The moment he breaks. The moment he betrays the one person he loved, the one person who represented a flicker of hope in his otherwise bleak existence.
And the saddest part, he thinks he's won.
That's the ultimate tragedy. Winston embraces doublethink as a form of self-preservation. He convinces himself that he loves Big Brother, that the party is right.
That final scene, with Winston sitting in the Chestnut Tree Cafe, drinking his victory gin, a shell of his former self, it's just devastating.
It's a chilling reminder that totalitarian regimes don't just want to control your body, they want to control your mind.
1984 is a warning, isn't it? A reminder of what happens when we become complacent, when we allow ourselves to be manipulated, when we stop questioning the narratives we're being fed.
Absolutely. It's a stark reminder of the importance of individual liberty, of critical thinking, of fighting against oppression in all its forms, even when it feels like hope is lost.
Because in the end, the fight for freedom, for individuality, for truth, it's a fight we can never afford to give up on. Well said. And on that note, I think we've done our due diligence in exploring the depths of Orwell's dystopian masterpiece.
It's a book that stays with you long after you've finished reading it.
It does. It makes you question everything, makes you appreciate the freedoms we often take for granted. To all our listeners out there, keep questioning, keep thinking critically, and remember, Big Brother is always watching, or at least it can feel that way sometimes. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time with another fascinating world to explore.